Hey everybody, welcome back to Engage in the Phenomenon. And today we have a very special guest, and that is Jeffrey Mishlove, who was the creator of Thinking Aloud and now New Thinking Aloud, which is a phenomenal show and broadcast. It's one of the most epic shows ever to cover consciousness, remote viewing. And of course, when you're doing all that, you're going to run into UFOs. And he's had people on such as Jacques Vallée, John Alexander, and many more great minds who have dealt with the UFO subject, but also psychic phenomenon. So welcome to the show, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And again, like I said, anybody listening, go check out New Thinking Aloud. And it's a YouTube channel. It's got such a great wealth of interviews. Literally, you could your next few years could be filled with research with the depth and the breadth that is covered there. Is there anywhere else people should look, Jeff, for your work?
NewThinkingAloud.com is the best. It's A-L-L-O-W-E-D. And it's all one word, New Thinking Aloud.
All right. So to start off, you know, even just recently, I say recently, but really in the last few years, right, you've had Leslie Keene on, and, you know, everybody here is going to be familiar with her. She has done incredible work on the UFO subject, you know, what we can call UAP nowadays. And, you know, she's done, you know, she had been part of the story in the New York Times that broke the news about the ATIP, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, and her book, UFOs, you know, Generals, Pilots Go on the Record is a hallmark. So you had her on recently and you guys discussed some of the recent UAP revelations and news and where they're going. So you have a pretty clear insight into some of those, some of that, you know, the information regarding that. You know, what do you think about all the recent news regarding UAP with the recent disclosures, we can say?
Well, it seems as if more and more information is gradually coming into the public domain. And we're looking at what, by all accounts, appears to be a very physical phenomena tracked on radar with visual spotting by people in the air, and I think even aboard aircraft carriers, as well as video. So it suggests to me, given my own experience working more in the parapsychological domain, that the phenomenon that we associate with UFOs is probably many different things that get lumped together. There could be phenomena that are purely psychological. There are probably phenomena that are purely parapsychological and other phenomena that are purely physical. And they sort of get lumped together because at the end of the day, they're all unidentified aerial phenomena of some sort.
Absolutely. And again, that's a fascinating take. And, you know, getting to some of that, right? You went into that a little. What do you think is responsible for the UFO phenomenon?
Well, again, I think there are many different sources that are responsible. If we let's take the pure nuts and bolts, the idea that these are physical vehicles, I would say that there is a very good likelihood that they're extraterrestrial. When you just look out at the sky at night, and I live in New Mexico, where we have, except for when there are forest fires, we get beautiful skies at night. And you can see that within, let's just say, the local area of the galaxy, within 1,000 light years, there are hundreds of stars. And these stars have, we now know, have planets, and a number of these planets are going to have conditions that are favorable to life. And it makes sense to me that in our local neighborhood of the galaxy, it's quite possible that there are other spacefaring civilizations. If they're just a few hundred years ahead of us, they might have the capability of interstellar travel.
Right. I mean, it's incredible to me to think in the last 100 years how far we've come. You know, if you looked at people 100 years ago, they probably would have never even thought about like the internet, right? Or you know, quantum computing, whatever even that is, right? It's just
incredible. In my own childhood, these things were inconceivable.
Right. And I mean, it's mind blowing. So even 100 years from now, we're going to be, we can't even imagine because of the exponential effect of technology, you know, artificial intelligence, quantum computing. Like I can't even really explain what those things are exactly, but I know that they're super profound. And again, yeah, people like to kind of write off the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but I think at least for some, just for some of the phenomenon that's observed, that it's probably the most likely in a sense of where, like, it really makes sense that, yeah, there would be beings from another solar system that have advanced a little farther than us. You know, getting a little deeper into the UFO stuff, you know, here on this channel, we deal with CE5 sometimes, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, or human initiated contact, or what's called HICE, human initiated contact events. And in my interview with Luis Elizondo, he somewhat confirmed in ATIP, they actually had terminology for that, and it was called cognitive human interface. So do you have any experience with that at all, or even just knowledge?
Well, that was a big part of the research that I did that was published in a book I wrote called The PK Man. It came out in 1999, as I recall. It was based on a 10-year research project that ran from 1976 to 1987, when I worked with a fellow named Ted Owens, who claimed to be, in his own words, Earth's ambassador from some sort of hyperspatial entities. He didn't say they were from another planet or another star system. He said they came from another dimension. And he referred to them as the space intelligences. He was quite specific with me. He said that they found him. They've been around a long time. He said they were the ones who gave Moses his powers, and they came upon him because he, according to himself, was the first person since Moses who had a strong enough nervous system that could wield these kinds of energies and powers. And they operated on his brain and worked with him his whole life to teach him how to communicate with them telepathically so he could do that. And then he would perform demonstrations. I have in my files 168 demonstration records in which he would send out written notices to scientists saying, I am going to perform this demonstration, typically something very unusual like a UFO appearance or heat waves in the middle of winter and cold waves in the middle of summer and controlling earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, volcanoes, large scale things like that, power blackouts. And he, I would say his track record was roughly 2/3 of the time things worked out as he said they would. And I would give you a rough estimate that by chance alone, those events had a probability of less than 1%, let us say. And on one occasion, I asked him to create a UFO's sightings. He said he would produce 3 UFO sightings within 100 miles of San Francisco within a 90-day window. And we set up a control for that experiment, which was we looked at San Diego, a city of comparable size on the West Coast in the same time frame. I sent out hundreds of letters to law enforcement officials within 100 miles of both cities. Nothing whatsoever was reported during that time in the San Diego region. In San Francisco, we got two sightings, not three, but on one occasion, and these were very serious sightings. These were, the first one occurred when a fellow was abducted in the city of Concord, California. It was reported in the local newspaper. We interviewed him, a person who had no interest in UFOs, was out late at night. But then Owens called me up. He said, I feel it coming. This is going to be big. This is going to be seen by hundreds of witnesses. It will be photographed, and the photograph will be published on the front page of one of your local newspapers in the Bay Area. That happened like 3 days after he called me to tell me about it. And not only was it photographed, it was videotaped, and the videotape was shown on the Channel 9 evening news in San Francisco. And in that occasion, the UFO was not only seen by hundreds of people on the ground who happened to be outside with cameras, because the art department at Sonoma State University was sponsoring this event with an aerial artist named Stephen Pileski, who flew an airplane with smoke trailing out the back and making designs in the sky. That was his artwork. And this UFO came right into his airspace, 3,000 feet above the campus, lozenge-shaped UFO. So it was seen from the air and the ground simultaneously, and photographed and videotaped, just as Owens said he was going to produce. He claimed he caused this to happen through, whether it was psychokinesis or whether it had to do with this telepathic connection he claimed to have with the space intelligences, I'm not sure. Incidentally, he called them, the two space intelligences he worked with, he described as large, mantid-like beings. And he named them Tweeter and Twitter. He said they made squeaky, high-pitched sounds. He also said they were energy beings, and they lived in a large, invisible, giant UFO hanging above the planet. And they had a big device in which they could see the mental images that he was projecting to them.
Did he ever talk about a kind of methodology and how he did that, or he just said?
Yes, he created what he called a PK map. In other words, a drawing. He would make a drawing of the events that he wanted them to create. And then he would concentrate on that drawing and send them a mental picture of it.
Do you know if he was ever, if Ted Owens was ever looked into by like Stanford Research Institute or even any of the government programs?
Well, in fact, it was the people at Stanford Research Institute who first learned about him. They were doing research back in the 1970s with Uri Geller. And I'm talking about Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ, who were friends of mine back in those days and still are. And they invited me to visit them to learn about remote viewing. This would have been February 1976. And at the time, California was going through a major drought. And Ted Owens was sending them letters all the time. They had achieved some publicity for their work with Uri Geller, the Israeli psychic. And Owens would write to them and say, you're wasting your time working with Geller. I'm the world's greatest psychic. Well, you should be studying me. And he said, just to prove to you that I'm the world's greatest psychic, I, Ted Owens, the PK man, the Earth's ambassador, am going to end the drought that's taking place right now in your community, Menlo Park, California. He said, in fact, all of Northern California at the time. And you will know that it was me who ended the drought, because there is going to be rain and sleet and hail and snow. There are going to be power blackouts and UFO sightings, which are my trademarks. And within a couple of days, your local newspaper, which as of that day said no end to drought in sight, within a couple of days, they'll publish a story saying the drought is over, all of which happened. So, and that's when I showed up at SRI International, big military industrial think tank. And Puthoff and Targ were all abuzz about this. They were very excited, but they didn't want to have anything to do with Ted Owens because they were getting funding, as we now know, from the CIA and military intelligence. And the last thing they wanted was a flamboyant psychic. They were already feeling too much pressure from working with Uri Geller. So they gave me all of their files on Ted Owens and said, why don't you follow up on this case? I, at the time, was a graduate student studying parapsychology. So they were very happy not to be able to work on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's actually pretty fascinating too, is that, you know, I believe Uri Geller said, you know, he came out later sometime and said that he had a contact experience in his early life that in his opinion helped facilitate his abilities, maybe not the cause, but opened him up to them somehow. So that's another fascinating note. And also for people listening, you know, Hal Puthoff was involved with the ATIP program and the OSAP program. So, you know, he's still at it doing the work, right?
Yeah, Hal Puthoff still is very involved.
Yeah. So, you know, again, just an interesting note for people listening. Were you ever able to get Hal Puthoff on your show?
Actually, not yet. I haven't interviewed Hal. I have interviewed Russell Targ on many occasions. And let me go back to Uri Geller, whom you mentioned. In the book Uri, published by Andrea Puharich, there are extensive descriptions of Puharich traveling in Israel with Uri Geller and witnessing UFOs. And in fact, they had with them at the time a psychologist from Wisconsin, my home state, named Ila Zeebel, who also witnessed these UFOs. I made a point of contacting Ila Zeebel, who seemed like a neutral witness, and interviewing her. And she corroborated all the accounts that are there in the Puharich book about Geller. So it's later on in Geller's career, he wanted to minimize the focus on UFOs. He tended to downplay it, but actually he never denied that all of the extensive reports that appear in Puharich's book were true.
Right. And again, that's so fascinating how, you know, the world of UFO and the world of psychic phenomenon seem intimately connected. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't seem to fully explain one without the other in some way. That's, again, something I find fascinating. I've had experiences where it seemed apparent that, you know, what we call psychic phenomenon was part of the equation and what was going on, you know, whether it was, you know, telepathic lock-ons or downloads and things of that nature. So thank you so much for sharing that, because I didn't even know about that book. So that's a fascinating point. Now, just to kind of circle back now, you know, here you are, you know, you're involved with people like Ted Owens, Hal Puthoff, Russell Targ. You know, how did you even get into all of this, right? Parapsychological research, you know, parapsychology, psychic phenomenon, and, you know, and in that, you know, getting tangled up into UFOs to some extent.
Well, I guess if I was to choose a starting point for you, we could go back to 1972. At the time, I was a graduate student in criminology at the University of California at Berkeley. I was doing volunteer work at the psychiatric unit of San Quentin Prison, doing group therapy with murderers and rapists. And I wanted to switch. I wanted to study human deviance, but positive forms of human deviance rather than negative forms. It was getting rather depressing working with murderers and rapists. And I didn't know how to do that. There were no programs at the university. You could study crime and psychopathology at any university, but if you want to study creativity, intuition, UFOs, parapsychology, there were no opportunities really. And I agonized over this for months and months until one day I had a sense of knowing that after all these months of struggle to come up with a way to break out of my criminology track, I was going to have a dream. I knew that the answer was going to come in a dream. And in fact, I went to bed knowing that tonight's the night the dream will come. And it did. I had this dream that I was visiting some friends in Berkeley. I got to their apartment in married student housing, knocked on the door, no answer. And in the dream, I found their key, let myself in, looked in on the floor once I was in their living room, and there, smack in the middle of the floor, was a magazine. And in my dream, I picked up the magazine. It was called I in the dream, E-Y-E. And I began paging through it when I woke up with this feeling of, aha, this is the answer, I have it. But when I woke up, I realized, even though I was certain I had the answer, I didn't know what it was. So I acted out the dream. I put on my tennis shoes, ran across Berkeley, 5 miles to married student housing, knocked on the door of this apartment. Nobody was home, as I had dreamt. And in fact, I knew where they kept a key, under the doormat. And so I took their key, let myself into the apartment, walked into the living room, and there, smack in the middle of the floor, as I had dreamt, was a magazine. I picked it up, and this particular magazine was named Focus rather than I. It literally brought focus to my life. If you have viewers or listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, they may know Focus was the magazine of listener-sponsored radio and television, KQED, in the San Francisco Bay Area. So as I was paging through the magazine, it dawned on me for the first time in my life that I could pursue my interests in the higher forms of human deviance by getting involved in the nonprofit segment of the media. So I went to the local Pacifica nonprofit radio station in Berkeley, California, where I lived, KPFA, and said I'd like to volunteer, even though at that point I had my master's degree in criminology. They said, well, good, sit here at this desk, and when you hear the doorbell ring, press this buzzer and let people in. And I was happy to do that. I did it. And within 3 weeks, I had learned how to produce radio programs. I did a program on local psychics. You don't have to be from out of town to be psychic. And at that point, the program director thought it was pretty good, and they said, we have a regular slot for you every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, at noon, actually. You can host this program called The Mind's Ear. And so within a few weeks of my dream, I found myself sitting at a table with world-class experts, everyone who had written a book on some subject related to consciousness passing on through the San Francisco Bay Area on a book tour would show up at KPFA radio, and I'd be interviewing them with 10,000 people listening in. This gave me the confidence to go back to the university, taking advantage of some obscure rules of the graduate division, and create an individual interdisciplinary doctoral major in parapsychology, which is what I did.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And, you know, that's almost kind of like a precognitive or retrocausal effect right there. Now, from that point, how did thinking aloud come about?
Well, the program that I did, of course, at KPFA, that was in 1972. And I worked on my doctoral program in parapsychology, which I earned in 1980, at which time I was libeled, actually. The skeptics were, this is the only doctoral degree ever awarded in parapsychology by an accredited American university. And the people who think of themselves as skeptics, but who are really more appropriately called scoffers, because they hate this field and they don't even want to see any research in it. And they put enormous pressure on the university not to grant the degree and even to revoke the degree. And when they couldn't get the degree revoked, they began arranging for articles to appear in major publications saying that if I did get the degree, I certainly didn't deserve it. I was incompetent, and I had to spend the next 6 years fighting a libel suit, which I won at the end of 6 years. In fact, to the extent that I have wealth these days, it began back then when I won a substantial financial settlement as a result of that lawsuit. But it was then, after the lawsuit was settled in 1986, that I launched the original Thinking Aloud television series. We started out on a local public access cable channel, and from there we jumped to a local PBS station, and they sponsored us for uplink to the satellite. So within a couple of years, we were out on 100 stations all across North America.
Yeah, and you know, just I had no idea that you actually had to go through all that and that you had dealt with those difficulties. So, you know, I mean, that just goes to show how much of a pioneer you are, you know, in this work and in this field. So we, you know, I know all the listeners and, you know, the people who have come after you, which are, you know, you're one of the people who was a trailblazer. Now it's like, okay, to have a show like this, like what, even what I'm doing here. So, you know, thank you so much for your efforts and believing in yourself and in the work. So, you know, I greatly appreciate that. But the I just to finish out the kind of your progress over there, how did you go? Where did it go from Thinking Aloud to New Thinking Aloud?
Oh, okay. Well, the Thinking Aloud program ran on national public television and also on Canadian television from 1987. Through 2002, and we managed to obtain funding to keep it going for 15 years, which is a long run for any TV show. And at that point, we kind of ran out of money, and I got involved in other projects until 2015, when circumstances had changed, the whole market had changed dramatically by then, and I had some cash available and space available, and I acquired a TV studio situation. I began doing interviews again and launched the new Thinking Aloud series.
Yeah, well, you know, you have some legendary interviews, let me just say. I mean, I want to say your interview with Jacques Vallée, probably the best interview that's publicly available with him to this day. It's, you know, and especially again for its time, just epic. You know, when was that and what was that like?
Well, the very first time I interviewed Jacques Vallée, I remember it very clearly because it was 1973. This was for KPFA radio at the time. I was then living in a very unusual circumstance. I had been invited to move into the Institute for the Study of Consciousness in Berkeley, which had been set up privately by the founder, Arthur M. Young, who was the man who invented the Bell helicopter, the very first commercially licensed helicopter. It came out in 1947 with a little glass bubble and the skids. And he built that helicopter, and then he became an avid explorer of consciousness and psychic phenomena and a cosmologist. And he was like a mentor for me. So, I did the interview there. I had a portable tape recorder. Jacques Vallée came over to the Institute, and it was a date night for me. I was dating a woman named Janelle Barlow, who is here in this house with me right now in Albuquerque. We've been married 43 years at this point, but that was 5 years before we even got married. And so she was with me when I interviewed Jacques on that occasion.
Oh, congratulations, 43. Well, I'm not even 43 yet, man. I hope to be there someday. But what about the interview that you did on, I don't know, it has to be Thinking Aloud, right? The video interview that you did with him?
Yes, yeah. I interviewed Jacques for the Thinking Aloud TV series. But, you know, that would have been like 30 years ago.
Yeah, easily. I mean, Jacques Vallée was young. I think you had hair. But it was, I mean, you know, he was talking about things like, oh, man, just a ton of stuff. It's and, you know, and even now it's like the, some of those ideas are only becoming more popular, you know, now are finally being thought about as, you know, probable and likely regarding the UFO phenomenon.
Well, his main insight was that if we want to understand UFO phenomena, we should look at the history of similar kinds of phenomena reported in earlier periods of time, including fairy lore, including mythology of the Vedas. He was suggesting that this is a phenomenon that's been going on for a very long time, that it might not be extraterrestrial at all. It might be terrestrial. He was totally open to looking at other possibilities in addition to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And he was particularly interested in the fairy lore and the folk tales of that you find in virtually every culture.
Yeah, and I think he highlights that in Passport to Magonia. Yeah. And it was actually funny. I believe it's in his interview or your interview with him that he said, you know, I'd actually be upset if I found out it was only little green men. So, you know, and again, some other interview you did, you had John Alexander on talking about, you know, remote viewing and stuff. And then he actually came on, I think a little later on after, this is probably when New Thinking Aloud was around, and he was talking about the Christopher Bledsoe case and his new book, Reality Denied. And he kind of runs the gamut on that one and goes from, you know, almost every type of metaphysical experience you can imagine. Did you ever look into the Bledsoe case?
Well, not personally, no, but I can tell you that I lived in Las Vegas, Nevada, after we moved out of the San Francisco area in 2001. I lived in Las Vegas from 2001 to 2018. And John Alexander and his wife, Victoria, were my best friends living there. So I got to know them very extensively and had many, many long conversations with John about his explorations. He's been all over the world chasing down all sorts of exotic phenomena, everything from UFOs to Bigfoot.
And yeah,
he's a real adventurer. And a world traveler and a very interesting man. Some people think that he's some sort of disinformation specialist. As far as I'm concerned, that's all BS. It's just idle speculation by conspiracy theorists, and there's nothing to it.
I mean, you see a lot of that, and it's this, you know, I understand people's, I guess you want to say, caution, but also suspicion, because, you know, the UFO cover up, and I have to say at this point, there's been a cover up, or, you know, at least somebody knows somewhere that UFOs are real in the U.S. government. Somebody knows that, and that fundamental truth has been withheld. And because of that, you know, even people are saying the same thing about Luis Elizondo, and this guy had, you know, he left his job at the Pentagon to help, you know, put this story out there. And they're saying the same thing about him. So, but, you know, there's actually a kind of dichotomy there, because, you know, a lot of people, they automatically say, oh, you know, this person's a former CIA, a former DIA, they're disinformation. But at the same time, nobody was saying that about the Disclosure Project, from what I understand, as far as I know. And all those people were military witnesses telling their stories about, you know, their firsthand experience in the U.S. government with, you know, the UFO cover-up, essentially.
Well, so, I think you have to go back to 1938. Orson Welles did broadcast on War of the Worlds, in which it was the H.G. Wells novel. And Orson Welles did a reading of it on the radio, and people, and the reading was designed as if these are news reports coming in about a Martian invasion. And people listened to that on the radio. And as a result of the fact that the people thought it was real, they didn't realize it was a fictional portrayal, they tied up the phone lines and caused what later military experts thought could be a national disaster. And so back in the early days of UFO research, I think early 1950s, there was a panel, was it the Robinson Report or Robertson?
Yeah. And there was a Robinson panel, yeah.
The Robinson panel issued studied the phenomenon and said, we cannot panic the public about extraterrestrials. So what we're going to do is start, in effect, a disinformation campaign, because we can't risk having all the communication shut down because people panic.
Yeah, and I believe that's happened. Yeah. And because, again, so we're getting back to national security. Now, I believe Jacques Vallée also discussed that in the interview you did with him. And, you know, essentially what they ended up doing, you know, from what I understand, you know, from my research, is that, you know, even people within the government at that time, you know, subsequently weren't getting the information. So now, you know, you have ATIP, OSAP, UAP Task Force, and the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, was saying, listen, we need briefings on this. Why, you know, number one, why don't we know about it? And number two, we want some of the information available, because, you know, if this is going on, you know, we're the Senate Intelligence Committee, and we, you know, we need that information to inform our policy. And, you know, sure enough, they started getting briefings, and it genuinely seemed like the majority of those people had no idea of all these ongoing events. And, you know, some people speculate that, you know, whoever initiated the cover up, and obviously it's gone through several generations at this point, have, you know, they painted themselves into a black box. How are you going to explain that you kept this, you know, fundamental, you know, knowledge, you know, from congressmen and senators? And, you know, again, there's probably technical legal language and you know, kind of classified secrecy acts that protect them to an extent. And I don't think they did it necessarily illegally, but they definitely have managed to do it very cleverly.
Well, you know, it's been an open secret for over 50 years. When the Blue Book report came out, the Condon report, evaluating Project Blue Book in 1969, the report was very funny. If you read the introductory paragraph, they would say, no, we have no evidence for any kind of extraterrestrial visitors taking place. But if you read the details of the report itself, there's plenty of evidence in that report. and of course, popular media has never shied away from this topic. There have been, as you know, hundreds of books at this time and symposia. So the effort to kind of suppress it was only partially successful at best.
Yeah, there's been people speculating, Grant Cameron's one of them, that, they've slowly been trying to acclimate the public in different ways, even, through, connections with Hollywood. And there was like some bizarre documentaries made that I think it was UFO Cover Up Live. And the Pentagon actually worked with Bill Moore, Jamie Chandray, and I'm forgetting the director of the film now. Emerson. Is that his name, Emerson? I'm drawing a blank on the name right now, but the guy who directed the film, they gave the Pentagon gave him access, and they said they were going to give him footage from the UFO landing that happened at an Air Force base, and they cooperated with him to an extent. But then when it came time to give over the landing UFO footage, they said, no, sorry, we can't do that. But there were intelligence people involved in that. That's when, the aviary was involved. So you had Rick Doty and other people. I think Rob Collins, who was an Air Force guy too, and a few others were informed the research basically, and they put out, there was legitimate information in there and US government agents, and it was kind of like a weird thing. Actually, a gentleman named Robbie Graham he wrote a book called Silver Screen Saucers, and it discusses the relationship between the United States government and the UFO community in Hollywood, and how they've had partnerships essentially before to work on some of these UFO films, which, if the information wasn't available, it would sound ridiculous, but it did happen. So I don't know what to make of that. And even stuff we see going on today, it seemed like, people like Hal Puthoff, John Alexander, maybe John Alexander unofficially, and Luis Elizondo, Christopher Mellon kind of, went rogue a little bit to kind of put this stuff out there, and they had people in their networks who were supportive of it. And, now we're clearly seeing some kind of progress and acclimation to whatever extent. So what do you think, where do you think this is going?
Well, let me propose a hypothesis. And that is that, in order to become a spacefaring civilization, you have to be able to master hyperspace. In order to master hyperspace, you have to understand the nature of consciousness. And because I'm going to postulate, and there's good evidence and many publications, including my own book, The Roots of Consciousness, that suggests that consciousness actually resides in hyperspace. And in hyperspace, there are other realities. You can think of hyperspace as the world within, that we all have access to that world within ourselves. It's the world of dreams. It's the world of the afterlife. And it's a world in which spacefaring civilizations are adept. And we see this because in many of the UFO encounter situations, particularly those reported by Whitley Strieber, but certainly not limited to Whitley, you have instances in which deceased people appear alongside of extraterrestrials. That is, so there's some sort of commerce, you could say, of some kind taking place between the reality of extraterrestrial entities and the reality of disembodied humans. And until we're able to master that level of reality, and we're very far from it as a civilization now, we're not ready to join the Galactic Federation or the community of spacefaring civilizations. We're not yet developed enough or mature enough. So it's going to require not only the mathematical and technological development, it's going to require as well a level of spiritual development, which many individuals have achieved, but as a civilization, we're very far from that. And the fact that 40 years after I got my doctoral degree in parapsychology, not a single additional one has ever been issued in the United States is just one little sign of how far we have yet to go.
Yeah, for sure. You know, regarding some of the remote viewing and psi stuff, it seems that, you know, ATIP and OSAP kind of dabbled in that. And again, they had written, you know, 38 papers on science, you know, theoretical sciences that are kind of like really far out there. Do you think that there's still current U.S. government programs dealing with remote viewing or psychic phenomenon?
Well, I'm pretty sure that if such programs do exist, they're classified and top secret. So I have no direct information about that. But it would seem to me that they would need to be, because it's still very, very controversial. And you have people on the religious right who say this is all the work of the devil. And then you have people on the I'm going to call it the religious left, but what I really mean by that is the materialist left. But materialism, yeah, for many of these people is the same as a religion. It's a dogma to which they subscribe. They're convinced that the remote viewing is all fake. And so between the people who think it's fake and the people who think it's diabolic, it's very hard to run a government-sponsored program. You're going to get a lot of flack from people, including the people themselves who have been asked to administer these programs. So any government that wants to pursue remote viewing at this point would be smart to avoid publicity.
Yeah, yeah. And I know, you know, Dean Radin has done some great work regarding psychic phenomenon. And, you know, he explained that, you know, even if they have the studies and they have actually really good information, unless you can explain how it works, that's like science kind of doesn't want to look at it. You know, there's been, I guess, good studies done. And, you know, Dean Radin cites them in his books and things. Have you ever interviewed Dean Radin?
Many times, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I assumed you did.
Yeah.
What do you think it's going to take for that issue, right? The issue of psychic phenomenon or even parapsychology, right, to be taken seriously?
Well, it's a slow process. William James was a psychical researcher, which is the discipline that sort of preceded parapsychology. He was one of the founders of the field of psychical research back in the 1880s. And he said, you can't expect progress in this field decade by decade as we see in other fields. It's too fundamental. We have to look by the half century and by the century. And so I look at the literature from 150 years ago, and I see it still hasn't yet been completely absorbed in our culture. Although we are making progress, the progress is slow. William James was correct. We probably have at least another 100 years to go before this is going to be really integrated into society. And there are many deep reasons for that. One of them is that it strikes fear, subconscious fear in people. You don't want other people reading your mind, typically, which is the basis of that fear. You have secrets. In fact, Freud talked about the Freudian unconscious. We have things we don't want to know for ourselves. We hide from ourselves our own subconscious desires and drives if they're not socially acceptable. That's the Freudian unconscious. And so we certainly don't want psychics to be able to see things about us that we don't even want to know. That has to be overcome before we as a civilization are going to really advance.
And do you think now, I mean, there's technologies now that are, they're bordering on the line of like, technology interfacing with consciousness or the brain, even thoughts. Like that's the territory we're actually heading into now. You think that that's going to help or diminish the look into the psychic phenomenon?
I'm not sure I understood your question. Could you repeat it? Are you saying that there are technological means of reading people's minds? Is that what you're getting at?
In a way, like through neuroscience and things like that. And they're starting to implicate, technologies where you can think to the technology and it reads your brain and it knows where to go, kind of thing.
Yeah, you can send signals to biofeedback equipment in order. It's used for people who are handicapped, for example. It's used for jet pilots these days. If you want to pilot your aircraft and you're going at supersonic speeds where instant reaction is very important, you can do that, but it's very primitive. It's nothing like the sophistication of a good remote viewing that can be 100% accurate in great detail regarding targets thousands of miles away. There's progress taking place strictly at the physical level, but yeah. The thing is this: the brain, to my way of thinking, does not produce consciousness. The source of consciousness is not in the brain. I think of the brain more as a radio receiver. It's a receiver of consciousness that's coming from, we can say, hyperspace or another level of reality completely. And what the brain does is it acts as a filter because our nervous system and our survival needs, we don't need to know everything that's in our consciousness in order to survive. The research in remote viewing suggests that consciousness has access to all information anywhere in time or space. That's who we are. But most people are far, far from realizing that. And furthermore, if you were aware of everything all at once, it'd probably blow out your nervous system completely. People do report brief experiences of cosmic consciousness. Mystical experiences of this sort are in the literature. But for most people, to get by in life, to meet your survival needs of your biological organism, you want to function with a very reduced set of information. And that's what the brain does. It functions as a reduction valve.
Yeah, we filter out a lot of information, you know, even second per second. You know, our subconscious mind takes in all this information and filters out, you know, what, again, getting to the survival stuff, what it thinks we need to go from, you know, moment to moment, you know, is there danger around? Basically very primitive, fundamental types. But, you know, there's talk that, you know, meditation and these different practices can, you know, open that aperture a little bit, and you can kind of in a way begin to open yourself up to the greater realities, you know, and, you know, maybe not, that's not something everybody's ready for yet. What do you think of that, about like maybe meditation and parapsychology?
I try to meditate an hour a day if I can. And more millions of people are now meditating. When I first started out, when I graduated from high school, for example, meditation was pretty much unheard of. So, and yoga was very rare to see anybody practicing yoga. Now there are yoga studios all over the place, everywhere. So that's very positive to my way of thinking. And you know, the research is pretty clear right now. People who quiet their mind and quiet the brain, and as a result, it could be through meditation, could also be through psychedelic drugs, they quiet the brain. When the brain is quiet, the mind expands.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, you know, regarding CE5 or human initiated contact, you know, before you go through the process, the first thing you do is meditation, you know, and then you get onto the actual process of, you know, whatever methods you have for at least the CE5. There's people who go about it in different ways, but I say probably the majority of people actually start with meditation. And interesting, I want to know if you looked into this case before. It's a really interesting experience or case. Dorothy Ezat. Are you familiar with her case at all?
Dorothy
Ezat or Izat?
I have heard of it, but I cannot say I'm very familiar.
Okay. Oh, no, I was just wondering if it was like somewhere in your like hundreds or more for interviews, if you had one. Excellent case. There's actually, if you go on YouTube or Amazon, there's a documentary called Capturing the Light. And she just recently passed away, I believe in February, but extraordinary experiencer case. She had like thousands of reels of footage, which was very anomalous. And she's recording on an old 8mm recording device in like beginning in the 70s and onwards. And, you know, she was actually, her experiences started, she was in her house doing meditation and she felt this connection and, you know, told her to come outside and look. And sure enough, you know, her contact experiences began. So that's just a fascinating case. Is there any other question or any other kind of words you would want to leave to the audience?
Well, yeah. Oftentimes people ask me, as you did, you know, how did you get started in this field? And I tell the story of the dream that I had of Focus Magazine and so on. But I think the important point I like to leave with people is this. If you resolve to become the very best version of yourself, in other words, to get in touch with your destiny, to realize your full potential, to actualize yourself as a human being, the universe wants you to do that, and the universe will reach out to help you. That's what I found in my own situation. And I think it's largely true for people.
Yeah, and it's almost I don't want to say cliche, but it's almost like you got to take a leap of faith in some cases. And sure enough, I mean, I've experienced things like that myself for sure. So anyways, thank you so much, Jeff, for coming on. It's an absolute honor to have you on here. You're a pioneer trailblazer. You've done incredible interviews, and it's great to actually hear from you, talking about some of your background and your thoughts for once.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, James. I've enjoyed your program very much, and I will certainly let my viewers know about it. And best of luck to you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. And I hope to speak to you again someday, buddy.
I'd be happy to do that.
Definitely. You take care. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.